MacCast, Tuesday, November 26th, 2013. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. We sit here just days before the most American of American holidays. I'm talking about Thanksgiving. It's coming up on Thursday, and we engage in rampant eating and rampant consumerism. So what could be more American than that? Actually, it should be a lot of fun. I know a lot of you rush out and engage in the whole Black Friday sales and stuff like that. Apple has sent out their emails. I got mine. I don't know if you received yours about their deals. They are going to be offering deals in store on Friday. They'll be open on Friday. There was some controversy a couple weeks ago about whether or not Apple was going to have stores open on Thanksgiving. I think they have a couple stores open, like the New York store, a couple of their flagship stores, but most Apple retail stores will be closed on Thanksgiving. I think Tim Cook actually sent out a letter to employees to let everybody know that that was happening, that they were not going to be making their employees, most of their employees, retail employees, work during the holidays. So that is a good thing. But we're here now. We've got a lot of great Mac news and information to share with you this week. I always think, you know, after these big product announcements that Apple has, that things will slow down a bit. But there certainly was none of that. There's lots of stuff for us to talk about in this episode. So we're going to dive right into it. But before we get to that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, a new sponsor here on the MacCast. I told you about him last time. It's Lynda.com. For those of you who don't know Lynda.com, and if you've been working or living in the tech community at all, you probably do. But just in case, Lynda.com, it's a site. They offer these really high-quality video courses that help anyone who wants to learn anything in the creative fields, hone your business skills, software stuff. There's just a huge breadth. If you're into photography or into video or into programming or into design or you name it, the list goes on and on. You probably should just head over to lynda.com/maccast to check it out. They have all the details and information there. But over the years, I have used lynda.com several times to bring up my skills as a designer, as a developer. I think one of the best things about the site is just that incredible depth and all the separate categories and things like that they have, and all the things that they have. They have over 2,000 different courses, and they're adding new ones all the time. They're constantly updating the site, so they try and stay on top of the new technologies and the new things that are coming out and have courses ready and available for you right away. As a matter of fact, I told you last time, they got a bunch of great Mavericks courses going up there right now. They have a bunch there already, and they've been expanding that out. I really want you to check out lynda.com. So we have a deal for you. You can get free trial access to the entire library just by going to that URL, lynda.com/maccast. And just to help you get an idea of the kinds of things that you can do at lynda.com or the types of courses you can see, I had them create a special MacCast playlist for you of some courses that I thought might be of interest to MacCast listeners. So you can check that out when you go to lynda.com/maccast. You'll see those awesome courses on Mavericks. I also threw in some on iLife and iWork, as well as I'm a web developer, so some web programming courses. And so you can try all that for free. Check it out. And when your free trial is over, you can sign up. Their pricing, they have low monthly pricing starting at just $25 a month. And that gives you access to everything in that catalog. So I think you're going to be blown away when you check it all out. And don't worry about being overwhelmed, because they make it really easy to find the courses that you're interested in. You can browse by subject. You can browse by the software application. You can look for specific authors. So you find, if you find an instructor that you particularly like, you can check out all of their courses. And they have a great search functionality. So they really do make it easy. Just head over to lynda.com/maccast. There you'll find out all the details about the service, the various kinds of plans that they offer, and you can sign up for that free trial. That's lynda.com/maccast to take advantage of that. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. So kicking off the news, Apple has a couple new betas out to their developers. Let's first start off talking about iOS 7.1 beta that was released to developers just a little over a week ago. Its beta build, the number is 11D5099E, for those of you who are into that kind of stuff. Basically, we call it iOS 7 beta 1. It includes a number of bug fixes and performance enhancements. 9to5 Mac actually provided a lot of details on some of the more specifics in the update. There is a new closing animation in the pinch to close gesture on the iPad. That's the little forefinger pinch together gesture that you can do. So new animation for that. They added a bunch of accessibility updates, and it's interesting. I think Apple's doing a lot of accessibility updates that actually are made for the rest of us as well. This time around, they added a new toggle for a dark keyboard. So if you prefer more of a dark gray keyboard versus a light keyboard, you can turn that on in the new beta. They also added the toggling for the bold text no longer requires restarting the device. For anybody who had enabled that, so you can get a little bit thicker font. In iOS 7 right now, you have to actually restart your phone after changing that setting. That's going to be going away, so that'll be a nice addition to be able to toggle that on and off at will. And there's more controls to better reduce the transparency and increase the contrast. Some of that translucency stuff can be a little bit difficult depending upon your backgrounds and things like that. So if you have trouble seeing those sorts of things, you'll be able to play around with those settings with the new accessibility updates. And then there were some camera updates in there. A couple nice, really nice options. One, there's an option to upload all of your burst mode photos to PhotoStream. That's for iPhone 5S users. There's a new auto HDR mode, which will automatically select the best HDR photo. So when you're using HDR, it'll look at the three exposures, just pick the best one. And if you want to keep all of your exposures, you can just turn the standard HDR mode on. So just use it as normal. But if you're like me, I don't like to have all those extra exposures. I usually just pick one of them. So I'll probably play around with how good the iPhone is at figuring out which one is actually the quote unquote best one. We may have a little disagreement there. But then there's also an indicator now that will let you know when you have the flash in auto mode, whether or not it's going to fire or not before you take the photo. That's a nice addition because I'm constantly, I don't like flash photos in general, so I typically leave it off, but occasionally I'll accidentally have turned it on at some point and then not realize it's on. So it'll be nice to have a little visual indicator to say, hey, dummy, the flash is going to fire. Is that really what you want? So I'm looking forward to the updates in iOS 7 Beta 1. It's out to developers right now. So in testing, if you are a developer, you can get it on the developer website. You can download that latest build if you haven't already. And then also released to developers was macOS 10.9.1, the first major beta release for, or point update, I guess I should say, for macOS 10 Mavericks. Apple did push out a little maintenance update to kind of fix some of the issues with mail, and I told you about that on the last episode. But this 9.1 update was pushed out to developers. The build number there, 13B27, and Apple has asked developers in the release note to test mail, the graphics drivers, and some of the voiceover accessibility stuff. Some noted updates in the beta are improved compatibility with VPN servers in OS X server. Also, 10.9.1 Mavericks will now periodically update shared links in Safari. So if you use shared links in Safari, that'll help make sure that that stays up to date. The update also resolves a problem with VoiceOver when it was being used to read emoji characters. So not sure exactly what they would have changed in there, but it's going to let you know what, I guess, maybe better descriptions of those emoji characters. And then the beta is available to registered app developers right now through Software Update or through Apple's Developer Center site. So again, two updates there, one for iOS and one for Mac OS X for developers. There's a really cool technology built into iOS 7. It's kind of more of an under-the-hood notifications GPS sort of thing, but it leverages the Bluetooth 4.0 technology that's in Apple's latest devices, iDevices, and it's called iBeacons. Apple showed it off at WWDC. I think they talked about it in a couple of the keynotes. Well, we're now getting some reports that Apple may be getting ready to actually implement iBeacon technology in their retail stores. The plan is to provide shoppers with an enhanced shopping experience in their retail stores using the iBeacon technology. Basically, iBeacons is a thing that takes advantage of Bluetooth 4.0 and little transmitters that can be put in different locations, and those transmitters can communicate over low power Bluetooth to a iBeacon-enabled app or device and alert you to to various things as you move around. They can be used also in office. I mean, there's lots of applications for these things, but retail applications is going to be one of the big, I guess, elements that everybody's talking about. And so in this case, Apple supposedly plans to install the iBeacon transmitters in their retail stores, and they're going to work with Apple's App Store app. So as you're walking around the App Store or the retail store, excuse me, and you have your app in your pocket or your iPhone with you, walking near a product or display can actually trigger an action to happen within the app on the device. So it could pop up and alert you to the features of the product, give you feature information, give you pricing for that product that you're standing near. It could also alert you if an item was on sale as you're walking past it. So kind of give you information. I would assume it and really hope it's something that you would have to opt into, but it sounds kind of neat. I'm a little hesitant because it also sounds like it could get a little bit annoying. I think you know, if you've been listening to the show, that I'm not the hugest fan of notifications. I think our society is becoming very interrupt-driven, and this is just another way to kind of interrupt us. But if they do it in a really elegant way and it makes the shopping experience more helpful, then I guess it could be a good thing. No word on exactly when Apple will have this rolled out in their retail stores. I would think they would want it out for the holiday shopping season, but I'm not hearing anything about it being out on Black Friday or anything like that. Now, one store might actually beat Apple to the punch, and that could be Macy's, because a report came out saying that they're also planning on implementing the iBeacon technology. Actually, it's an app developer, and they're partnering with a number of retailers. It's an application called ShopKick, and I guess it's already a shopping app that lets you flag items that you want to buy, and then will alert you to in-store offers on those products and maybe recommend other products that you might like. I think there's a social element to it as well. According to TechCrunch, they're actually going to be running a limited test with Macy's in San Francisco and New York, installing little, what they're calling Shop Beacon transmitters. So again, little transmitters strewn throughout their retail locations that would work in conjunction with the ShopKick app, both on iOS and on Android. And what it would do is, if you have the app and you have it enabled, you have your preferences in there, as you're walking past a beacon, it can trigger an alert on your device. And they say they even have the ability to, with an opt-in feature, allow the beacon to actually automatically open the application and trigger an action. So take you to a specific page or a specific offer or take you to specific information all automatically before you even take that thing out of your pocket. So it sounds pretty cool. And I would imagine if the ShopKick test proves to be successful, they're going to be rolling it out to their other retail partners in the U.S. That includes companies like American Eagle Outfitters, Best Buy, Crate and Barrel, JCPenney, Old Navy and Sports Authority and Target. But right now, they're just rolling out this limited test of the technology in those two Macy's stores. So I'm not in either one of those areas. If you happen to be in New York or San Francisco and you are a person who uses the ShopKick technology, I'd be curious to hear a report from a MacCast listener on how the technology works. Is it annoying? Is it something that's actually useful? Is it just kind of gimmicky? I think it could go almost any way. And I really think it's going to come down to the implementation of the technology within the app and sort of the value-added service that it offers. Hopefully, consumers add some value in there, and it's not just the kind of thing where it's like, hey, this is on sale, this is on sale, this is on sale. I would imagine that could get really annoying, especially if it's rolled out to a lot of retailers. You're walking through a mall and your phone is just constantly, you know, like beeping at you. It's just, that doesn't sound pleasant to me at all. But hopefully you can opt in and opt out as you'd like. We'll have to see. But, you know, iBeacon technology is going to be an interesting emerging technology, not just in this retail space. But I think there's a lot of other really cool applications, and I think we're going to see more and more of it. It almost gives you like indoor GPS capabilities. So think of a shopping app in the supermarket that could guide you to an aisle where your product is. That could be fairly useful. Or if you're in a museum or you're in a new zoo or something like that, it could help direct you to a specific animal or a specific exhibit, something like that. And then not only that, it could give you more information within the app, pop stuff up, more information about maybe a gallery piece you're looking at or something like that. So there's some really cool applications here, and I'm looking forward to see to seeing how this stuff is implemented. But, you know, what do you think? Are you ready to have your device notifying you about everything as you walk around the mall? And I do have some concerns about what kind of information might be getting sent back, especially if it can be coupled with analytics within the application. So you think of something like Flurry analytics being coupled with, hey, this person was at the actual retail location. We alerted them to this ad. They actually clicked on this thing. It starts to get maybe a little creepy. So, you know, there's some things to think about. We're going to be talking a little bit more about security and privacy and data and information a little bit later in the show, so stay tuned for that. Are we and Apple ready for some larger devices? It's sounding a lot like Apple is getting ready to deliver larger tablets and larger smartphones to us. We've been hearing rumors about bigger iPads for a while now. And again, this time we're hearing from the Korean Times that Apple has lined up a supplier to make a 12.9-inch and almost 13-inch iPad. The report says that the displays are going to be ultra-high-definition UHD quality. They don't cite an actual resolution, but for reference, most ultra-high-definition displays, things that are being marketed like that out on the market, are spec'd out at 3840 by 2160 pixels. So a lot of pixels in there, a lot of resolution in there, and yeah, especially at a 13-inch size. I'm not sure. I haven't done the math to work out the pixels per inch there, but I would assume it's above Retina quality at this point or higher than Apple's current Retina quality. Some reports have claimed that Apple could release this larger iPad maybe in March, but DigiTimes seems to disagree. They've been saying, and a Boy Genius reports, that the supply chain checks they're doing have Apple placing orders with Quanta Computer for larger iPad model displays or for production of larger iPad model, and that release is set for sometime late in 2014. That would seem to line up with what I would think Apple's typical release cycle for the iPad is going to be, you know, coming out sometime in the fall toward the end of the year. I think Apple's going to stick to that release schedule, so I would tend to fall toward that. DigiTimes tends to be hit and miss on Apple rumors, but more often than not, they kind of get it right, so I'm starting to trust their information a little bit more. And in the same report, Boy Genius report claims that Apple is lining up Inventec, Quanta, and Foxconn to actually build an iWatch. And they're saying they wanted to release it in the first quarter of 2014, but that has now been delayed until the second quarter. I'm still having a hard time swallowing this whole iWatch rumor. To me, I just don't see a smartwatch, at least in the forms and with the functionality we currently see in the marketplace, as a really viable product. I don't think it's something that consumers are really clamoring for. I don't think it solves any sort of consumer problem. And if the recent reports of the success, or probably more accurately, the non-success of the Samsung Galaxy Gear smartwatch or any indication, it seems to, you know, jive with the point I'm trying to make. I think it's likely that Apple is developing some sort of consumer wearable product. The media is calling it an iWatch just as a generic term, but I don't think it's just going to be a watch. It's going to be a lot more than that. I think it's going to have some fitness and some tracking capabilities, a lot of sensoring and monitoring capabilities beyond just what we would think of as a smartwatch right now. It's likely something that's going to, in typical Apple fashion, shock and amaze us. It's going to have some stuff in there that we just haven't thought of. And I also think that, like John Martellaro over at the Mac Observer has been talking about, if you read some of his posts, I think in order for it to be successful, whatever device, whatever smart device, wearable device Apple comes out with, it's going to have to have functionality that allows it to operate autonomously. So many of the products out there right now rely on being coupled to your iPhone to get any functionality out of it, really. You kind of have to have that data information. I think Apple's going to develop a product that is a wearable that has some standalone features and then can be further enhanced by being coupled with another device, with something else that we have, but you'll be able to own it on its own and still get a lot of value and functionality out of it. And so that sort of product I could see Apple putting out, and I would imagine Q2 to me sounds even a little bit too early. I think maybe toward the end of the year, Apple would be ready to kind of have a market for developed for this thing or have a product that would actually be a viable product in the marketplace. But we'll have to see. I could be proven wrong. I know a lot of people would like to see Apple put something out in the space sooner than later. And not to be left out, of course, the iPhone has to have its rumors about its growth as well. And I don't just mean growth in terms of sales and market share. I'm talking about an actual bigger thing, right? We've been hearing this from multiple sources over the years. The latest rumors are now coming from a Chinese blog. They're claiming that Apple is testing an iPhone 6 model with a 4.94-inch display, an almost 5-inch display. Now, compared to some of Apple's competitors, that's not that big, but that's still a pretty good-sized screen, at least in the Apple world. It'd be almost a full inch up from what we currently have. And this would seem to be in line with some other reports that we've heard from people like KGI security analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. He says that Apple intends to have a scaled-up version of the iPhone for the next release, something in the 4.5 to 5-inch range that would be out sometime in 2014. Again, I think Apple's going to stick to that standard release cycle sometime in the fall. And Bloomberg is also reported that Apple will finally step up to a larger screen iPhone. They said it actually could have a slightly curved or convexed glass display. It would be very subtle, and this is something that, it has been debated in terms of the merits. Does curved glass actually do anything for the functionality of your device, or is it simply a design gimmick? A lot of people are sort of arguing over this. I saw some recent reports. I want to say they were from the Display Search guys, but I couldn't find the article. I was trying to look for it. But I think they said something to the effect that there actually is some a benefit to having a slightly curved glass display in terms of reduced reflections on the display. So that means you're going to get a little bit better color accuracy, it's going to be a little bit easier to see in bright light conditions. So if there are some actual real world advantages to that, I could see Apple doing that. But if it's just to get, a new shape that's a little bit different, I don't know. I mean, Apple would do some stuff for just design reasons, but that one seems a little out there to me. I like the shape of the current phone, and I don't think it needs to be curved to better fit my hand or anything like that. Maybe there's some of the other reasons why you might do that. The debates are now looking at more what size will Apple land on in terms of a display. Is it going to be 4.5? Is it going to be 5? Is it going to be bigger than that? But as far as resolution goes, I think most of the reports I've been reading have been putting it at about 1920 by 1080, so full, 1080p HD display. That seems like a good place to land in terms of resolution. And while I get the reason why some people would want a gigantophone, as Ken Ray likes to put it, I don't think that I am one of those people. So I really hope that if Apple does come out with a larger form factor phone, that maybe they expand the product line and we get a couple different size options. If Apple can actually do like a 4.5-inch display without significantly increasing the form factor, the actual physical dimensions of the device, I think I might be okay with that. Maybe if it goes further out to the edges, it could get a little bit larger, but I really want something that I can put in my pocket. A lot of people are saying Apple wants to stick with the smaller form factor to keep that one-handed use argument. I think the current iPhone, the taller one, 4-inch display, isn't really one-handed. I still have to kind of shift my hand around a little bit. Granted, I don't have the largest hands on the planet, but I don't buy that argument anymore. I don't think that's it. For me, it's more about with the large phones, not wanting to have to carry around a man purse to put my phone in, or not having to walk around looking like I've stuffed a tablet down my pants. I just want something that fits nicely in my front pocket of my jeans I can walk around with. And some of these huge phones just, they don't do it for me. So hopefully Apple can give us some options. I know there's a lot of people that really like those larger devices, especially just in terms of size of text and ease of use for. And I'm in that camp as somebody who's getting a little bit older. Your eyesight's going a little bit. I'm probably due for some reading glasses here pretty soon. So I believe me, I get it. But I still like the portability of my iPhone. And if I want something bigger, that's when I'm going to grab my iPad or iPad mini, something like that. So I think Apple's already got that problem solved. I don't think we need a bigger phone to do that. But that's just sort of my opinion. The Apple TV got a update this week. Apple quietly added a couple new channels to your Apple TV. Yahoo Screen and PBS content is now available. They just sort of pushed it out. They don't have to do a full-blown update to push out these new channels. They just kind of show up on your Apple TV. So if you haven't popped open your Apple TV, do it. You'll see these new channels there. Yahoo Screen actually lets you view episodes, clips, and get digital exclusive content from a number of different providers. I went on there. It looked to me like it was mostly clip stuff, but they have content from Saturday Night Live, Comedy Central, ABC News, Wired. They also have movie trailers in there. So there's a lot of varied content. I don't spend a lot of time on Yahoo on the desktop, so it was interesting. I think Yahoo Screen is also available in your browser, but on the Apple TV, the interface is really nice, and it's easy to bring up content and stuff like that. And since it's video content, I think it's a much better viewing experience. So I might play around with it a little bit more to see what's in there. But I was more excited and had wondered why it took so long for Apple to actually get a PBS app on the Apple TV. Now, if you go in for the PBS content, to get the most out of it, unfortunately, you have to go through an activation process. They want you to sign up for a PBS account or log in with your Facebook or Google account. I don't like this experience on the Apple TV because I think it's really disjointed. You go into the channel and it pops up on the screen. It gives you this code. You have to go to your computer or your iPad or your phone and actually visit a website and plug in the thing. The process isn't really complex, but it's just extra steps. And it's like, I just want to get at the content. Can I just tell you my zip code and you can find my local PBS content and all the stuff you need? So I'm sure it has something to do with wanting to be able to market for the pledge drive. You know, it's public supported television, and I actually love PBS. I am a PBS member, so I don't have any problems doing it. I get it, but it does sort of encumber the process a little bit. But once you're registered, the app offers some amazing content, including regional content based on the local station that you've selected. And it's all free, both the Yahoo channel content and the PBS content, completely free. You don't have to be tied into a cable subscription or anything like that. So I really like that process. And I think it's a great addition to Apple's Apple TV product. It makes it even more useful than it was before. I'm a big fan of the Apple TV. So I think there's going to be a lot of people getting new Apple TVs this holiday season. I find it kind of cool that Apple is getting more and more into their manufacturing processes, working, it seems like, closer with their manufacturing partners. And I think a couple weeks ago, we started hearing about this story that Apple was looking to build a glass factory, a sapphire glass plant here in the U.S. And it looks like they've been moving forward with those plans to build that plant. They want to build it in Mesa, Arizona. And we started getting these reports that what they were going to do is buy this old solar plant in the area and then convert it. I guess it was actually a solar company that kind of built up this factory and then went out of business before they ever started doing anything. So it's sort of been sitting there vacant. And so what they want to do is buy the property, convert it over, and then have a partner company, GT Advanced Technologies, actually run the plant to produce sapphire glass for Apple. And Apple uses sapphire glass as a component right now in iPhones, iPads, and iPods. One use is for the camera lens to cover up the eyesight lens, and then the other use is for covering Apple's Touch ID sensors in the iPhone 5S. So they want to have a supplier here in the US. They want to have, I guess, tighter integration with it. And so they're moving forward with this project. Now, before they could buy the old factory, Apple was looking to have it rezoned as a foreign trade zone. And this was so that they could get some tax breaks. They wanted the area government to extend a zone that was in a nearby airport to actually cover this plant facility. So they've been going through that rezoning process. But in order to do that, and the process of rezoning would actually allow Apple to save up to 70% off of their property tax bill in the region. Really good deal for Apple. But in order to do that, they needed approval of all of the tax authorities that would receive money from those property taxes in the region. So it was something like 7 different authorities had to kind of approve this thing. So it went through, it might have been 8, it went through the first 7 of them, I guess, really quickly. But then things got hung up with the last entity, which was the Gilbert Unified School District. The board had a meeting and it reportedly kind of got heated, and they held off taking a final vote for the approval, I guess, because 2 people were kind of holding out on the approval. After the board meeting, actually, an Apple spokesman reportedly told board members that several other states were vying for the project, and that, frankly, if it didn't get approved in Arizona, they had other places they could go. So I don't know if that statement sort of put pressure on these board members, or if the fact that it was pointed out to them that even with the tax subsidies, the district would still get $2.5 million in funding from the approval. Whatever it was, they decided to go ahead and approve it this week, and it is reportedly going to be moving forward. So in addition to the tax incentives that Apple's going to get, the Arizona Commerce Authority also apparently had offered Apple a $10 million grant if they would come to the region. I guess what's happening now is Apple is going to foot the bill for converting the plant into a factory to make the sapphire glass. That's going to cost them around $578 million. And then GT Advanced Technologies is going to reimburse Apple for that expenditure over the next 5 years. Apple's total investment in the region will reportedly be somewhere around $1.5 billion and will supposedly bring an estimated 700 jobs to the area once the factory is complete, and offer an additional 1,300 construction jobs while the plant is actually being built. So good news for Apple. They're going to be able to move forward with the project, get this plant built, and we'll have another U.S. supplier of parts for future iPhones and iOS devices. And who knows if they have future plans for the Sapphire technology. We've read rumors in some various areas that Apple does plan to maybe see if sapphire glass could be used in other products, maybe in things like displays for their MacBook Pros or iMacs. Those would be some pretty big, expensive pieces of sapphire glass. But I think by getting closer to the manufacturing process, maybe Apple can help do some R&D to kind of bring costs down and maybe make those kinds of products viable. And that might be part of their interest. I assume that's probably part of their interest in kind of doing projects like this and getting closer with their manufacturing partners. Apple has pushed out an update for iMovie along with several updates for their latest iWork suite. iMovie 10.0.1 was pushed out this week and is a maintenance update. If you remember, iMovie 10 was part of Apple's big iLife iWork update, all those updates that came out alongside macOS 10 Mavericks. The 10.1 release notes say that it now allows iMovie to be installed on computers with some older video cards. So if you had an older model and you tried to upgrade to iMovie 10, couldn't do it, you might try again. The list supposedly has been expanded in terms of the supported computers. It also addresses some reliability issues when updating projects and events from previous versions of iMovie. So if you ran into troubles there, you might want to grab your backup copies of those old projects and try and reopen them, see if it does a little bit better job under 10.1. If you're running iMovie 10, you can get the update through the software update options in the Mac App Store. Apple also released some much-needed updates to the new iWork 13 apps. They updated all three applications. Keynote's been updated to version 6.0.1, Pages to 5.0.1, and Numbers to 3.0.1. And they all bring back the customizable toolbars. That was a feature that was lost when Apple did the big update, and a lot of people were concerned or complaining about that. So that feature is now back. You can customize the toolbar. Along with that, all of the updates get reliability, stability improvements, and bug fixes. That's typical when Apple releases the S updates specifically within each application. Keynote 6.0.1 has 7 new transitions and 7 new builds, so they've expanded the number of builds and transitions. Pages 5.0.1 brings back the center and edge guides, and they are now on by default. So if you were missing those guides before, they are back in there. And then Numbers 3.0.1, it now lets you set the default zoom level in the preferences and will preserve your window sizes and the placements of your windows when you're saving documents. Along with the Mac versions being updated, the iOS versions also received updates with bug fixes and improvements. You can get both the iMovie and iWork updates via the Mac App Store's update tab, and also the iOS versions you can get through running software update in the App Store on your iOS devices if you're not using the auto update feature, which in which case you may already have those updates on your device. You know that I am not the biggest fan of talking about Apple's lawsuit stuff. To me, it's kind of one of the most boring things that we can talk about, that I can talk about. And frankly, by the time I give you the information, what I've given you is probably inaccurate because there's been some sort of reversal, some sort of appeal, some sort of change, some sort of statement from the judge that alters exactly what the facts or the settlement or the ruling of the case is. So I feel like it's just an ongoing cycle of never-ending lawsuits. But this time around, I think we need to talk about the fact that Apple is going to get, or maybe will get, $290 million from the settlement in the patent infringement case against Samsung. This was the one that started back in 2012, where Apple won the lawsuit over a number of patent infringements. I guess I was going to say alleged, but Samsung was found to be infringing back in 2012, and the jury awarded damages of $1.05 billion. It was a huge settlement, huge story. Well, since then, there have been a number of alterations and changes to that settlement. The first thing happened that after a review of the sum, Judge Lucy Koh threw out $450 million of it, finding that the juries had improperly calculated that portion of the award. So then there was the remainder of the settlement, $410 million, and that went to a retrial, and this week a decision was handed down in that retrial case. Samsung was actually looking to have the awarded amount reduced all the way down to $52 million. Apple was looking to get about $380 million of the original $410 million settlement. After 2 days of deliberation, a jury came back and decided that Samsung should be on the hook for about $290 million. It's a little bit actually more than that. So, of course, Samsung was not happy at all. After the settlement, Samsung actually filed a motion for an emergency stay in the case pending the results of a review of the pinch-to-zoom patent that Apple had. That's one of the patents they were found to be infringing on. The judge actually denied that request. So it's expected now that Samsung will, of course, appeal this latest judgment. So will Apple or ever get their money? Who actually knows? As it stands right now, I guess Samsung owes Apple about $929 million in total for all of the lawsuits that have been ongoing for infringement of Apple's iPhone and iPad-related patents. I'm sure that amount is going to go through flux and change. Again, this is this never-ending lawsuit battle. And what happens is there's these retrials and appeals and then new lawsuits. There's new patents that are going to be tried. There's new products that come out that are found to be infringing. A lot of these products and things that we're hearing about now are old products because these are lawsuits that started 2011, 2012. You know, they've just been ongoing. So, sigh, you know, it's... to me, not super exciting, so I generally won't cover the small ones. But this one was a pretty big deal. This was the big case, the $1 billion settlement case. And it looks like at this point, Apple is due to get about $290 million out of that. You know what's cool about following up a boring lawsuit story? That the next story, almost no matter what it is going to be more exciting. And what could be more exciting than an airport base station firmware update? Yeah. Apple has released Airport Base Station Firmware Update 7.7.2. This is for Airport Extremes and Airport Time Capsule base stations, the 802.11.ac models. It actually fixes a bug that prevented USB hard drive that was connected to your Airport Extreme from being recognized and available for use as a Time Machine volume. That's actually something that I think Apple struggles with and has been struggling with the airport for a while, almost all the model airports. It's something I generally just tell people to avoid because it never seems to work all that well. But hopefully this time around, they've got it nailed down and it'll fix that issue. The update also resolves a problem that could cause intermittent loss of WAN connectivity. So that's not a good thing either. And addresses an issue that could result in a network loop. Not exactly sure what a network loop is because I'm not an IT engineer, but that to me, again, also doesn't sound like a good thing. So if you own an 802.11ac airport or time capsule base station, you probably want to grab this firmware update. You can grab it by simply running the airport utility on your Mac or running the airport utility application on your iOS device. If you don't have that app, it's available for download in the App Store. Guess what? The new Mac Pro is now on record as the most expensive desktop computer ever sold. This is from any manufacturer. And no, Apple didn't just update their website with a new 12-core model. It's not something that's spec'd out with all the bells and whistles. They didn't up the price on the premium-priced model. Actually, what happened was Sotheby's had their red auction to benefit the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, and that auction included several items that were custom items designed by Johnny Ive and Mark Newsom. Excuse me. And the Ivan Newsom Red Mac Pro, a special edition, one-off edition of the Mac Pro, went for a staggering $977,000, almost $1 million for a Mac Pro. Kind of makes that $4,000 six-core model look like a bargain by comparison, right? The pre-auction estimates for that Red Mac Pro were between $40,000 to $60,000, so it far exceeded the initial estimates, which is awesome for the charity. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS is a great, great charity. Apple supported it with their products for a number of years, actually for a long, long time. And since what was the original product? The Bono iPod, you remember that? I think that was a Project Red thing. It might have been Apple's first one. But for this auction, there were a number of other items that were Apple related or in the set designed by Ive and Newsom. There were rose gold Apple EarPods. Those sold for $461,000. There was a custom Leica digital camera designed by Ive and Newsom. That was $1.8 million. And then they had this red desk, this really cool looking desk, that was $1.6869 million. Approximately that went for. In total, they raised about $13 million for the cause. So super, super successful. And wow, that's an expensive Mac Pro. I think we talked about last time that there was this rumor that Apple might be acquiring PrimeSense, the company that made the original sensors, the motion sensors for the Microsoft Xbox Kinect product. Well, this week, an Apple spokesperson did tell CNET that the company did in fact acquire the motion tracking sensor technology company PrimeSense. Apple, of course, declined to discuss any of the details on what they paid or what they plan to do with the technology or the company. It's not something they ever talk about. But the deal is thought to have been in the neighborhood of $345 million. We do know from statements that were made by Tim Cook that he sees the sensor market as playing a huge part in the future of technology. So it would make sense that Apple wants to invest more and more in sensor-based companies. Apple buys smaller companies all the time. They talk about that quite frequently when these sorts of things come up, but they really don't go into any detail on exactly what they're going to do with the companies they acquire. But of course, anytime this happens, it rekindles a lot of speculation in the media, among analysts, about what Apple plans to do, and this acquisition is no exception. Most people seem to think that Apple plans to use the technology in the creation of a television product, that it will have a future Apple TV product would have motion control interface. This one just seems bizarre to me. I know that there's been some smart TVs out there that include this kind of technology, this recognition technology, where you use air gestures to change the channel and up and down the volume and stuff like that. I don't know if I really want to play sort of air guitar to control my television set. It feels a little funky. Can you imagine sitting around in your living room doing that sort of thing? And how can it tell if you're just not watching the football game and something exciting happened? You jumped up off the couch. The volume might go through the roof. I don't know. I guess they can figure out how to avoid false positives and things like that. But it just seems weird. What maybe makes more sense to me is that Apple might look to put the technology into the set-top box Apple TV or bring an add-on product, maybe a Bluetooth or a USB attached product that would be more in the gaming space to be used as a motion control accessory for something like gaming. So if Apple would bring their game apps to the Apple TV platform, that could be really interesting and sort of expand Apple's play into the set-top box gaming market or just the gaming market in general. It would open up a whole new platform for game developers using Apple technology. So I think that could be interesting. There's also some who feel that the technology could be integrated with future iMacs and MacBooks to allow motion control from your desktop or your laptop. And I even have seen now some people alluding to ways that Apple might be able to integrate the technology with iOS devices, maybe your iPad. I guess in some ways, Samsung's played around with that a little bit, right, with a sort of swipe over the top of your phone kind of gestures that you can do. Again, not something that ever really excited me, but Apple's obviously interested in expanding their sensor portfolio, and I think this PrimeSense acquisition is probably a pretty good one. I think the creative people at Apple could figure out a way to use this technology in some pretty impressive ways in the future. And then the last thing that I have for you today, poor Siri. You know, she must be down on her luck because she's had to turn to actually shilling iBooks for Apple. TUAW actually found out something interesting that can happen if you ask Siri to locate a bookstore for you. In addition to some creative responses, sometimes she'll say things like, outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. So she gives those little pithy comments. And I've noticed she started doing this. It's weird when I ask Siri some questions occasionally, ask her for information. So sort of add these little humorous antidotes or jokes or like it's additional content on top of just the standard canned response. And it's cute and it's kind of clever. I could see where it could get annoying if it's too excessive. But in this case, sometimes when you ask her for that information, what she'll do is come back and be a huckster for Apple's own iBookstore. She'll specifically say, I don't know if you'll find what you're looking for, but if not, give iBooks a try or something like that. iBooks TM, right? You got to have the trademark in there. And I get that Apple is being cute and clever with their marketing and that some people might find it kind of endearing. But at the end of the day, when I saw this and experienced it myself, it's really like Apple inserting an ad for their own products into like search results. So it's basically like doing the whole Google thing or Yahoo thing. It's almost like getting a banner ad in your Siri content. And I think of a Siri interaction as a functional interaction with the operating system. It's something at the OS level. And I don't want necessarily ads in my operating system, even if they're ads from Apple. So, it just makes me think, how far away are we away from getting a response like, oh, I noticed Thor isn't in your iTunes movies. Would you like me to buy it for you on the iTunes store? When you ask for, say, movie times for the new Thor movie, Thor Dark Worlds, right? It could extend that far. That's not that big of a leap from what they're doing here to sort of expanding how they're marketing and trying to upsell you on their own products and services. So I hope that's not the direction that this is moving in, but that popped up this week and I thought it was worth pointing out. And I do find it a little bit concerning. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's Transporter by Connected Data. You know, I love my Transporter. For those of you who don't know what it is, Transporter is a product. It is a peer-to-peer storage drive. It lets you privately share and access and back up your files. It's like a private cloud. What that means is that it's this little box, this little appliance that you buy. It's got a 2.5-inch hard drive in it. You plug it in, you plug it into your network, you run through some configuration software, set up an account, and then you have your own private cloud. It becomes a storage device that you can access from your Mac, you can access it from your iOS devices, your Android devices, you can access it from anywhere, but your data never leaves your network or your device. It's all accessed directly from there. So nothing goes up to the cloud. You don't have to buy any kind of additional service. You just pay for the transporter. You hook it up on your own network. It's amazingly easy to set up and configure. You can use it for backup. If you have two transporters, you can actually have them sync the data directly from one to another. You don't need to leave your computer on and connected to actually get back from, say, your iPad to access that data, because it is a network internet-connected device. So once you have it on your network, you just leave your transporter on, and you always have access to your files back securely back to your own device through your own network. It's really, really cool, and I really like the product. I'm using mine more and more frequently. It's able to sync files from the transporter to other Macs, from transporter to transporter, so it's actually really, really versatile. If you want to check out and find out more about it, you can go to filetransporter.com/maccast, and when you're ready to buy one as a MacCast listener, you actually get 10% off your purchase on the transporter store. So as you're checking out, when you get to the point where you can enter a coupon code, just enter the code MacCast, and you'll save 10% off your own transporter. And this is the transporter unit with a drive, because they just recently came out with something called the Transporter Sync. This is a new product. If you'd prefer to bring your own hard drive, what you get is you get all the features and functionality of the transporter in the Transporter Sync, but it has a little USB port on it, and you connect your own USB external drive for the actual storage. So it'll use your own drive for the storage, and you get all the features and functionality of the transporter. That's not part of the 10% discount, but the Transporter Sync costs just $99. So go to filetransporterstore.com, enter the code MacCast to save 10% on your transporter. Go to filetransporter.com/MacCast to get all the information and details and check out all the products, including the Transporter Sync. And a big thank you to Connected Data and Transporter for their support of the MacCast. Do you remember on the last show we were trying to help out our listener Todd, who was having an autocomplete on Twitter handle problem with Apple's tweet sheet in Safari? Wow, that sounds overly complicated. let me re-explain that. So you know how in Safari you can click on the share button and you have Twitter as an option, and when you do that, the little tweet sheet, that's what Apple calls it, comes down, and you can start typing in a tweet to send that, you know, URL on that website out. And if you type the at symbol and start typing someone's Twitter handle, it does this autocomplete thing. And what Todd had discovered was that in many cases, it would not complete the names of people he was actually following or had at tweeted on Twitter in the past. And this even included not finding people that he was actually following, including myself. So, of course, I had a vested interest in making sure that he could resolve this problem. And I didn't have time to actually test my theory, but I threw out a theory in that episode that maybe what was happening is Apple allows you to put Twitter handles in your contact database. So I thought, well, maybe it's just only pulling the Twitter handles from the contacts. And I suggested running update contacts using the update contacts option from your Twitter account preferences. So when you go into system preferences, internet accounts in Mavericks, it's actually under mail contacts and calendars in pre-Mavericks versions of OS 10. There's a little button you can click on there once you've set up Twitter that says update contacts, and it will go through all of your contacts' email addresses and try and match those up with people on Twitter and fill in the Twitter handle. So I suggested that to Todd, and I thought, great, problem solved. Well, guess what? I was wrong.
Hey, Adam. Todd McCann from the Trucker Nut Podcast here yet again. you recently tried to tackle a question I had about the share button in Safari on the Mac and how the search function really stinks. You had suggested that you thought it wasn't pulling in those contacts from Twitter, but you thought it was pulling them from contacts. Well, I got to thinking on that, and I thought, well, of course. But then I thought, well, I'm a truck driver. I don't even know anybody. Certainly don't talk to anybody. And my contacts list is very, very small. And furthermore, I don't have any Twitter handles listed in the Twitter fields. So I'm still wondering where those lists are coming from. Actually, when I type somebody's name or start to type somebody's Twitter handle in there, the list that it brings up, 99% of them are not even in my contacts list. They're just people that I follow on Twitter. This happens, I should mention this happens in my iOS, too, on my iPhone. I thought I'd do some checking on this, some more testing. So I opened up my contacts app on the map, and I started adding Twitter names for people like you who were already in my contacts list. added your Twitter handle in there, and then rebooted and everything. I did this for a bunch of my friends too on Twitter. Did the reboot, came back, started typing in MacCast. It brought up Mac Tips Daily. It brought up Mac Geek Gab. Did not bring up you. It's just amazing that the people that I actually talk to the most on Twitter and the people that I at the most on Twitter they're never the ones who pop up first. And I don't know. I'm just at a loss. I'm hoping maybe your listeners can come up with an answer for this. I hate to quit using this feature. It would be a really handy feature if it freaking worked. So hopefully you can help with this. Appreciate your show as always, Adam. And I voted for you again. So didn't know if anybody knew this, but you can vote on these podcast awards every single day. So get your butts over there and do it. All right. Thanks, Adam. Ciao.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate the votes over at the Podcast Awards. Actually, those are closed up now, I think. I think voting is closed. If not, you can head over to podcastawards.com and check it out. But hopefully, I will win my first podcast award this year. But let's get back to your issue. I learned the lesson there, and I knew this already. I should have tested this before I actually made the recommendation to you. I did test it now and confirmed exactly what you said. It does not matter what's in there. I have exactly the same problem you're having when trying to use this feature. So I am at a loss. What is the secret sauce here? I did some Googling. Of course, that's the first place I turn to when I can't figure something out. And I found others saying they have exactly the same issue, but no one seems to have a fix for this. But the MacCast community is amazing. It's large. You are incredibly resourceful and creative people. I know that there is a solution to this. So one is, where is this mythical autocomplete Twitter handle information data coming from on our Macs? And how do we get it updated? How do we get people in the list that we want and maybe even remove people from the list that we don't want on there? If anybody has the answer to it, email us maccast@gmail.com and we will get to the bottom of this, I'm sure. Now I want to talk to you about your privacy. This is something I promised a little bit earlier in the show, and it came up this week because I've been on several podcasts over the past couple weeks recommending this awesome new trivia game. It's an app that hit the App Store. It's called QuizUp, and I fell in love with this game. It's actually really well designed. It has some awesome features. Has a ton of categories, which is something that I really love about it. It's also a very social app, so it relies a lot on Game Center. It's something that you would challenge your friends, play against your friends. So it uses integration with services like Twitter and Facebook to help find people that you know who are also using the app so that you can match up and challenge them to trivia. And it does this sort of real-time, pseudo-real-time gameplay. It also has a turn-based gameplay, so you can actually challenge someone, and if they're not available to play, they can come back and play at their leisure. It's actually, again, really well-designed, really well put together, and I was really impressed by it. So, of course, I've been recommending it all over the place, recommending that people get on there. Well, this week, the app came under some scrutiny over how it handles user data and privacy. So my heart immediately fell because I love this game. And also, I just felt bad because I recommended it to a bunch of people. And a developer, a guy named Kyle Richter, was able to determine that the app was doing some things. It was sending and receiving some data, things like email addresses, gender, birth dates, location data, even your contact database, sending information to and from the app in a clear or plain text format. And this is the kind of thing that actually, if you remember, specifically with the contacts information, that Path got into trouble with and resulted in getting fined reaching a settlement with the FTC of $800,000 over sending address book data sort of in the clear. And Kyle wrote up this blog post about his findings, about the things he discovered, and also notified the developers of the QuizUp app. He actually didn't do his posting till he notified the QuizUp developers about his concerns over the security and data, the things that he had found, and they didn't respond to him after several days. So he wrote up this blog post, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And in that, he does note and disclose that he is a developer of another Trivia app, and actually a Trivia app that's been out on the App Store for a while called Trivium. And that was actually what prompted him to start looking into QuizUp, because obviously he has a vested interest in quiz apps, and also QuizUp was using his app name as a keyword in their store posting. And I kind of thought about that too, because we've had these other conversations about sort of how developers, you know, work the App Store system and game the system. And that one seems like, oh, that's kind of slimy, or that's not a good way to go. But it's actually probably really smart from a marketing perspective, because if someone's looking for a certain app in your category, then it would make sense that you'd want your app to also show up in those results so that they can do a comparison on the App Store. So I think that's probably something that's pretty commonly done, and I don't think it's really egregious. It seemed weird at first, but kind of makes sense. So anyway, this popped up in Kyle's radar because they were using his app name. And the very first thing he was curious about was this feature of real-time gameplay, because they advertise it plays in real time. And he knew from his development that that could be technically difficult. So he started looking at the traffic going back and forth, trying to figure out, hey, how are they doing this sort of real-time gameplay thing? And he was using some readily available tools to kind of monitor the traffic going back and forth. And when he was doing that, he noticed that as you would challenge and play others, and you can play complete strangers in the game, it was kicking back a lot of personal information, like the email addresses of these strangers he was playing against in the data feed. And he could read that right there on his iPhone or his iPod Touch. And I was actually able to use a similar trick. I, you know, being a web developer, I know about some of this stuff and I know about some of the tools that are available. So I was actually able to see and confirm Kyle's findings. And I, as you know, I don't like to have just one side of the story. So I got in there, I had a private Twitter conversation with Kyle, got some more of the details about some of his concerns about the post, and got more information on the kinds of data that was being passed back and forth. His concern was that the app developer could, you know, be grabbing this information and using it as a potential gold mine to kind of market and you know, email out to consumers and stuff like that, people who are playing the game and that sort of thing. So there was definitely some privacy concerns here in terms of the data. Now, there is a point of clarification that I think is really important to make if you've read about this story or if you've seen it. Kyle's report said that the data is sent in the clear or is in the clear. I don't think he specifically said sent in the clear, but that is the distinction. See, the thing is all of the traffic was actually encrypted. The data going back and forth from the app to the QuizUp servers and back and forth, that was all going over SSL encryption, HTTPS. So that wasn't what was happening. The concern was that the actual data, once it was received, the data that was received was in a clear plain text format. So with the right tools, you could see that data once it was received on your iOS device, you know, just running some pretty easy and available software that you can get. And that was it. And the other problem was not so much that stuff was in the clear, but it was the kind of data that was in the clear. Things like email addresses, things like the user's Facebook hash or Facebook token, which could actually be used to potentially post on that person's Facebook account using Facebook's APIs. So that's kind of information that shouldn't be in there. It shouldn't be available and easy to read or get at. It should be hashed. It should be protected in some other way by the application. And this application really wasn't doing that. So it was more about you could get information from random strangers, and it was some pretty personal information that you could use to build an email list. And anybody could do this, so you could just run the application and sort of start building out, say, a giant email list of users of the QuizUp app, which you really, really don't want. So definitely some privacy concerns here. But then it's easy to jump to the conclusion and sort of be reactionary, and I did it myself. I was immediately upset about finding out about this information. I was angry at the developers. How could they do this? These people are doing something nefarious and evil. The kinds of information that was being sent really seemed unnecessary to the functionality of the app. But I had to take a step back and then stop and say, okay, what's going on here, and why would they be doing this, and that sort of thing. And you can make up all sorts of reasons as to why. You can make all sorts of assumptions about the developers, but I don't think that's fair to do. You can't just assume they're evil and they're scraping the data and they're using it for some nefarious purpose, like sending spam or marketing to all your Facebook friends or doing worse things. Well, you can jump to that conclusion, but I think that's wrong. I also think it's naive to assume that all the developers are good and they're not doing anything and this was totally innocent and, you know, those sorts of things. It's just some kind of mistake. There's a programming problem. Either one of those scenarios could be true. And you really don't know till you do a little bit more researching and thinking about this. You kind of have to ask people. So I went to Kyle. I didn't get a chance to go to the makers of the application, Plain Vanilla, but they actually, before I got further in this sort of investigation of this, they actually reached out and contacted TechCrunch. So their CEO, Thor Fredriksson, I think they're an Icelandic company, he responded to some questions from TechCrunch and said, you know, there's some errors in the blog post. We actually never send or receive data in plain text to our servers. And again, this is where the debate over the transmission versus the actual data that was contained within the transmission is. This is a, you know, they're saying one thing. Kyle was sort of saying another thing, and both parties are right. The transmission of the data was encrypted. The data itself, though, wasn't encrypted. And then QuizUp also said that they weren't retaining any of the data from the address book, so the contacts. So if you wanted to find other people that were in your contacts list, you know, it pops up like normal, asks you, hey, this app wants access to your contacts. What's not really clear, and never is clear, and all of the apps do this, is it then scrapes through your entire address book and sends that to the server so they can do this matching thing. The thing is on the server side, you have to assume, or you want to assume, that the developer's not storing that information. And QuizUp says they're not storing that information. They just use it to do the matching thing and then throw it away. And you kind of have to take them at face value on that. They, in order to get the data, they have to be able to send it. Now, they should actually be hashing it, and I guess in this case, they weren't. So they should have been encrypting that data on the app before they sent it through the SSL and then decrypting it on the other end, or at least hashing it, munging it up, so that somebody just sniffing the packets, just looking at the information going across the wire, couldn't extract that information out of it. And they weren't doing that. So they've admitted that there were some security flaws with how they handled the user's information. They said that was due to a bug in some of the third-party network libraries that they were using. They already changed the kinds of data they were sending and receiving from their servers, and I confirmed that as well. So they're no longer sending email address or the Facebook IDs or anything like that. That information has been pulled from the data stream. And really what's in there looks like what's just needed for the app to function. And it's not anything that isn't already available on screen in the app. So there's no extraneous data in there anymore. And they did put in a fix with the App Store. It was supposedly already in for app approval. So as soon as Apple approves that, it's supposed to fix up some of these other security issues and bugs. So again, what happened here? You know, was this intentional or was this just what they're saying, a series of bugs? And we'll never really know for sure. And I'm probably too naive or too trusting. I generally take people at face value. I lean more toward it being this sort of unintentional thing. And maybe it's also because I'm a developer. You know, I believe most people are inherently good, but also as a developer, I see this kind of thing all the time where developers kind of take shortcuts. They look at a bunch of data that they might need in an application and they just grab everything. They're like, I don't want to have to filter it out. I don't want to have to do the extra work. Just send me everything you got and then I'll deal with it on the application side. I'll sort of just pull in the information that I need. If you're a SQL, if you know anything about MySQL, it's a select star sort of mentality. And I see developers do it all the time. They need one bit of information, one column of data from a table, but they select the entire giant table to get everything back and they deal with it in code, whatever code they're parsing the information in. And I don't think that's a good way to handle it, but it's something people do. And it looks like that was kind of what was going on here. It was sort of like, just give me the entire JSON, the whole data stream, and I'll deal with it. And so part of the concern here was that you were getting this data that the app didn't need, and they should have been filtering that out. And it sounds like they're going to do that in the future. And moving forward, so, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean for us? Oh, I think another good sign was that the developer responded pretty quickly. So Kyle's post went up, and within 24 hours, they had contacted TechCrunch. They sort of explained themselves. They said that they were what they were doing, and I think that's a good way to sort of handle that thing. You know, respond quickly, answer the questions, don't hide from this stuff, especially if you just made a mistake and it sounds like that was what was going on, and correct the issues as quickly as possible. So I think they took that action, and as a matter of fact, I believe Kyle did a follow-up post. They got in contact with him, and they're working along with him to kind of address the issues and find out the kinds of things that he found and help sort of shore up the app. So I think it's going to be a okay app to use, especially if you get the latest version, the latest update. I don't know if it's out and available on the App Store yet. So the final question that sort of brings us to over privacy and I think iOS and our apps and stuff like that is a classic question that we have to ask anytime we're giving out our information, be it in an app or digitally or anywhere in our lives. And that is sort of who do we want to trust and believe, and who do we want to allow access to our information? And it's really a personal choice. My take has to always been to assume, at least with the internet and applications, that if I grant access to a website, to a service, to an entity, to any kind of information, that they have access to all of it. They have access to everything, and they could use it for almost any purpose. So inherently, any application that asks for access to my contacts is not allowed. I do not allow it. I never let an app, and as a matter of fact, QuizUp did not have permission to access my contacts. So I know that my contact information didn't go out there even when the app wasn't patched up. So you have to sort of decide, you know, where do I draw that line? And on the flip side of that, developers also need to start to be more proactive and more concerned about the kinds of data that they're pulling from us as consumers, and really be diligent about defining and only grabbing the information that they actually need and use. They need to be a little bit less lazy. And so I think between those two things, we can really make the system a lot better. But on our end, we really need to be responsible stewards of our own information and just decide what we're okay with and what we're not okay with. And if I'm okay with something and how an app's doing something, then I go ahead and play it. If not, then I don't use the app. If there's any concern, I don't use the app. And I generally don't sign into things. Another tact I take is not to use a sign-in with another service. So if the app only offers Facebook sign-on, I generally won't use the app because I want to have my own account on that. I don't want apps having access to my Facebook friends, to my Facebook data. I don't want them having access to my Twitter data and information. I really kind of protect that stuff as much as possible, or try and keep it siloed. You know, Facebook is already doing all kinds of crazy stuff with that data. I don't need other third-party companies outside of Facebook's control having access to that information. But again, that's my personal choice. Other people are perfectly fine with it, and that's fine too. We just all have to come to that conclusion on our own. And it's good to have stories like this that we can talk about and sort of bring up and keep this sort of conversation in the forefront. Because I think as long as we're thinking about it, we're all going to sort of, and having conversations about it, we're all going to be better protected. So I wanted to bring up that story this week because, again, it was something that immediately affected me because I was so heavily recommending QuizUp. I still think it's a great app and a lot of fun to play, and I'm probably going to continue to play it, especially now that it's been patched up. I have a question from a listener this week, Mikhail or Michael. I think it's Michael. He uses an iMac with an HDMI connected television set as a second monitor. And Mikhail, I'm sorry, Michael, if I'm mutilating your name. I'm just going to go with Michael. He lives in Sweden, so he watches TV shows or Swedish TV shows via Safari. Actually, I think it's his girlfriend who watches the shows. And to get a better viewing experience, they move that screen onto the television and then put it into full screen mode. And of course, that causes the iMac monitor, since there's nothing, no content on that monitor, to go to the standard simple dark gray background. And so he sent me an email and said, hey, I'd like to change that dark gray background to black so that it's darker, blacks out my iMac monitor, and it's not distracting from the content that I have playing on the TV. And there's not an easy way to do that because that's kind of built into the operating system. The one thought I had for you, Michael, would be to, since Mavericks will now allow you to run two apps in full screen mode, would be maybe put another application, open up another app, maybe like a painting app, Photoshop or Acorn or Pixelmator, put that in there, hide the tool palettes, and then go full screen mode and have just a canvas on there that is just 100% black. That might work. That could be a way to work around this thing. But I also did a little Googling, a little searching, and there was a trick. I found this over on Lifehacker. I'll have a link to their article in the show notes at maccast.com. But there was a trick to hack the dock application, which is in core services, to actually change the gray linen background. And you could do this in Mountain Lion and earlier operating systems, but I'm not entirely certain how you do it in OS X Mavericks. I couldn't find instructions for it. But basically what you would do is you would go into the root system folder in the library folder. There's a directory called, or a folder called Core Services, and inside there you find the dock app. And if you right-click or control-click on the dock app, you can choose Show Package Content. And then inside there, you go under Contents Resources, and there are the default background images for they control both mission control and the background in the full screen mode. And they're just that gray linen background, and it's called defaultdesktop.png and defaultdesktop2x.png. I think one is 256 by 256 pattern, and the other one is 512 by 512. And so you can create your own pattern files and replace the ones that are there. If you're going to do this, if you're going to try this trick, I would recommend, one, making sure you have a backup, but two, you probably want to backup those individual files inside the dock application. So like in my case, when I was testing it out, I just added, you know, dash old to the file name. So default desktop dash old .png and default desktop 2x dash old .png. And then I put in my own files, name them exactly the same, all lowercase, default desktop .png and default desktop 2x .png. And then you need to just reboot your machine or log out, log back in, or you can issue the kill all command on the dock if you know how to do that in the terminal. Just reboot the dock application, basically reset it, and then it will load your default desktop image instead of the default gray linen one. So you could do just a black square, have that be the pattern, and then you would end up with a black background. But again, this only works on Mountain Lion. Another cool trick is if you want to totally remove the background texture and just have a background that is an entire image, like a photo or screen, you can simply go into the same place, go under System Library, Core Services, Dock.app, go in there, find those default files and remove them. If you take them out of the dock, it'll default back to your default system image. And that one you'll find as a JPEG file called defaultdesktop.jpg inside the System Library Core Services folder. So if you replace that, I think in Mountain Lion, it was what the swirly galaxy thing would be the normal default image. You could replace that, and that would be the one that would come up as your background if you've done that. So again, the instructions for how to do all this are over on that Lifehacker article, the step-by-steps, if you want to get those, and I'll have that in the show notes. But I don't know how to do this on Mavericks because that default desktop.png is no longer present in the dock application. But if anyone out there knows how Michael might be able to get the second screen on his Mac when he's in full screen mode to go to just a plain black background, maybe there's a third party app, maybe one of these sort of, what do they call those things? Screen curtain apps, maybe that sort of thing, where you can black out one monitor and not have the other monitor blacked out. Shoot me an email, let me know about it, maccast@gmail.com. Next up, Jason emailed me about a OS X Mavericks bug that he ran into recently, and his timing could not have been more perfect because literally like the day before I got his email, I had run into exactly the same issue on my MacBook Air that I'm running Mavericks on, and it affects people who are running a Mac and using fast user switching. For those of you who don't know what fast user switching is, it's a feature in Mac OS X. It's been around for a while, and it gives you the ability, if you're running multiple users on a single Mac, to be able to switch quickly between accounts. And the way you enable it is you go into System Preferences, go into your User and Group Preferences, and then click on the Login Options. You may have to click the little lock icon and authenticate with an admin account if you require authorization to make changes, system-level changes, if you're not running an admin account. Once you do that, you click on the Login Options, and you'll see a checkbox that says, Show Fast User Switching Menu As, and then a drop-down selector to pick between full name, short name, or icon. So you want to check that option on and then decide how you want the little icon to show up in the menu bar. So you can either have it display the full name of the user that it's currently running under or the short name or just a simple icon. Pick whichever one you want. And then once that's enabled, what you have is you can click up there in the menu bar and quickly switch between accounts. And when you do that, you'll get this little roll away kind of cube animation that just turns the whole desktop around and switches you from one account to the other. You'll have to log in to the account when you go back to it, but it allows you to switch back and forth quickly. So the bug that's happening in Mavericks is that sometimes if you're running two accounts and you have one account that has Windows open, and then you fast user switch to a second account and then come back to the first account, when you come back to the first account, all of the windows get sort of pushed up off to the top left of the screen, like way up off the screen. And in a lot of cases, you have no way to grab them and bring those windows back into view. So they've sort of been pushed out of view. You can see the little edge of them up there in the corner, but it's really annoying because you can't get your windows back and you feel kind of stuck. And so this happened to me, and I tried doing various things like activating mission control, hoping that, you know, if I flew all the windows away and brought them back in, they'd come back to their original place, but that didn't work. Jason found that sometimes quitting an application and then just simply reopening it would restore the window locations. The way I figured out how to fix it was I actually ended up just completely logging out of that user account and then logging back in. And because OS X, you know, Mountain Lion maintains your open applications and the Windows positions and stuff like that, they all came back into place. But Jason, through some research, actually found a quicker fix for this thing. So if you've run into it, one thing you could do is you can simply reposition the dock to a different side of the screen and then move it back again. And I guess that will reset the window location. So you know how you can control click or right click on the little separator in the dock and then go under the position on screen. You can change that back and forth. Just change that around a couple times, and I guess you can get your windows back. In Jason's case, he was saying that when he was using fast user switching in multiple accounts, this was happening to him all the time. He could repeat it. In my case, it's only happened to me that one time, that, you know, right before Jason emailed me. So I'm not sure exactly what the trigger is, but I'm sure other people have run into this bug. And in case you did, there's a couple of options on how to fix it. If you have a different way that you fix this issue, be sure to let us know about that too. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now let's talk a little bit about storage on the iPhone and something that's a little bit confusing. Actually, Neil wrote in because he noticed that since upgrading to iOS 7 on his iPhone 5, that when he went in to look at the storage on his device under Settings, General Usage, he seemed to be missing almost 6 gigabytes of storage. There was like this mythical missing information. Basically, he'd go in there and on his device, it showed he had 52.9 gigabytes of data used. He had 4.3 gigabytes available. And he was wondering, you know, where's my missing storage? There's like 7 gigabytes of my 64. 52.9 and 4.3 don't add up to 64. And he said that wasn't happening in iOS 6, that in iOS 6 it would show actually 64 gigabytes of data between those two things. And what you've noticed, Neil, is something that I don't think is just iOS 7. I thought in iOS 6 the operating system was doing this same thing, but I could be wrong. It's been a while since I was running it. But at least what's going on is I think you're noticing two things when you go in there. One is that iOS itself is taking up a specific amount of storage space, and that is not available to you, and it's really not shown or indicated in those numbers. And then the other thing is this difference between sort of what I call Apple gigabytes versus actual gigabytes. So the first one is actually pretty easy to understand. iOS 7 uses approximately 2+ gigabytes of storage from the research that I've been able to do. So maybe 2.5, up to maybe 3 gigabytes of storage. So in your case, you have 7 gigabytes unaccounted for. So that leaves about 5 gigabytes that we need to figure out where that went. Well, the second place that we look for that is if you go to Apple's iPhone tech specs page and you look at the storage capacities when they're listing them out, you know, 64 gigabytes, 32 gigabytes, 16 gigabytes, there's this little superscript 1 next to that. And if you look in the footnote relating to that, it says 1 gigabyte equals 1 million bytes. Actual formatted capacity is less. And so you lose a little bit to formatting. That's probably not all that much. But Apple also counts 1 gigabyte as 1 billion bytes. And that's not reality. In reality, 1 gigabyte should be 1 billion 73,741,824 bytes. So Apple's not counting, in essence, not counting 73 million, almost 74 million bytes for each gigabyte. So with 64 gigabytes, that's actually quite a bit of bytes that aren't in there in the math. So if you start doing the math and you use real bytes versus Apple bytes, then what should be available in your iOS device with 64 gigabytes of storage would be 68,719,476,736 bytes. But Apple only counts 64 billion bytes, straight up. So the total max storage in Apple's case using the Apple bytes is actually 59.6 gigabytes, not 64. And so those are the numbers that you're seeing in the operating system because it's calculating 1 gigabyte equals a billion bytes. So you then subtract out the 2 gigabytes for the operating system and you have about 57.6 gigabytes left. And so Neil, your phone is showing 52 gigabytes, 52.9, almost 53 gigabytes being used and 4.3 gigabytes available. So you add those two together and you get 57.2 gigabytes, which is pretty close to the 57.6 gigabytes you'd have available once you subtract out the roughly 2 gigabytes for the operating system. So that would get you back up to the 59. So that is the mystery solved. That's sort of how it works. So reality is that the numbers that iOS show is actually estimated too low because Apple's not counting all of the bytes. They should actually be doing the math with a slightly larger number. And I don't know, you know, what that means in terms of that, you know, missing extra, what's, you know, 59. So we're looking at almost 4 gigabytes of missing information. You know, where that goes, what it is, if it's available for use or not, I really don't know. I guess technically, mathematically, you're still using those bytes. They're just not showing up in the actual display, right? I think I'm thinking about that right. It could be wrong. Someone's going to actually correct me, believe it or not. And hopefully I didn't get this wrong. But that's my understanding of why these numbers are slightly off. But that's going to do it for today's episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also TextExpander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for the iPhone and iPad, and check out their new PDF Pen Scan Plus. It's a great way to scan documents and get PDFs on your iOS devices that you can work with. You can get more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Connected Data by Transporter, or Transporter by Connected Data, rather. Get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control, security, and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. You can get 10% off your own personal cloud by going to filetransporter.com/MacCast. When you purchase your transporter and check out, be sure to use the code MacCast and you're going to get 10% off. And Gazelle, it's the fast and easy way to sell your used gadgets online. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. If you have any comments for me, you have a response to one of the things we talked about on this episode of the MacCast, or you have a question, comment for a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome those. You can send email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, you can check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. Great place to hang out with other members of the MacCast community, get answers to your questions. Lots of really smart people hanging out on the forum. So if you've never checked that out, be sure to go there and sign up, view some of the conversations going on there. If you'd like to follow me online between shows, you're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, what have you. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we're also on Google. Still waiting for my Google+ page vanity domain. Hopefully we'll get those sometime soon. But just search for MacCast on Google+ and you'll find the page. And I look forward to seeing you online. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.